We start another work week on this Monday afternoon right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio. Beautiful summer week ahead of us, I think. A lot going on today. I'm really excited about the guest in the second half hour, Jeffrey Edgers, writing about the electric guitar business and why it's dropping off. So looking forward to that. But, you know, I still look forward to talking to the Eno Boys, too. They usually start most Monday shows, and they're here in the studio now. Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke, welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Steve.
Did you guys practice that?
We did. We're about, what, 2 years in, we finally did it at the same time.
All right. Well, thanks for coming. We'll see you again soon. Either of you play the electric guitar?
No. Not nearly cool enough.
No. Okay. Well, I don't know. It's not as cool as it used to be, apparently.
Really? Why is that?
Well, we'll talk about it in the second half hour, but the idea is that there just aren't, you know, you think of the big rock stars right now, they're not really, you know, playing on the electric guitar that much.
You should have the reverb guys in here and talk about that, too.
Right, we'll bring the reverb guy in here too. And then Taylor Swift is going to serenade us on the way out. Okay, you guys are here, and Jim Dahlke, you just put a story up not too long ago. We get the Techstar roster for this year. Let's start out, you know, from 30,000 feet. What is Techstars and why is this significant?
Techstars is a tech and startup accelerator. They have programs all across the country, and this is where early stage tech startups come to get a mentorship, resources, a little bit of funding, and really it's a collaborative environment where they're really two-person startups that are growing into what hopefully will be a 10, 20, 50, 100-person fully-fledged business. But really, this is sort of the early stages of that. And Techstars has a class here in Chicago for the past 8 years or so. Just announced their latest class today. So we've got 10 new startups a part of the class. Techstars is one of the most well-known tech accelerators across the country.
And they've got different outlets in different cities.
All over the country, all over the world, really. It's an international program.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so it's always great to check in and see how they're doing every year. And kind of like every year, 10 very different companies. We've got swag.com, which the founders paid actually $200,000 for their domain name.
Isn't that great?
That's totally what jumped out of me. So this is a startup, and they dropped $200,000 on the website, the web name.
Exactly. And what they do is they help other startups, other businesses make swag, make t-shirts, branded water bottles, branded notebooks. Basically, if you are a startup, especially if you're in a place like WeWork, for example, you need to make t-shirts, you need to make hats, pens, pencils. And basically, they are able to offer their services to a lot of early stage companies. They work with companies like Facebook and Google, and WeWork actually uses them as a client as well.
Oh, is that right? I got Bennett working on a guest because we had a guy come in who puts insignias on all different sorts of things and made us some really cool bags, WGN bags. I want to give a plug if I can. So if you're a tech star, I'm thinking that you're, you know, living in your mom's basement or something. If they've got the money to buy that website, they're already up and funded. And they said they had Facebook as a client, didn't you?
Right. So that's the thing about Techstars. You know, everybody's kind of at different stages. Some companies are able to kind of get that friends and family angel round where you've got that sort of initial investment to pay for a domain like that to sort of get off the ground. Other companies are in sort of earlier stages even than that.
Right. Okay. And what is it that – what's the unifying sort of, I don't know, factor or personality or characteristic that all of these have? I mean, why would this work along with something like, I want to talk about a boat coming up.
The Techstars would tell you the people. They would say that these are all really, really impressive founders. So the reason why we're talking about it and why this matters is that, you know, it feels like accelerators and incubators, like a new one pops up every day, every week. We have on our site a list of, you know, these 10 are competing in this challenge, in this pitch competition. Techstar still matters. It's still really competitive to get into. And the 10 that are being chosen, and one of the things I like about Techstars is it's not industry agnostic. It is, if you're a really good founder with a great idea, kind of tackling a big problem, you may qualify for Techstars, and that's the kind of unifying thread. So you have a drone startup, you have a marketing insights, you have a bunch of AI algorithms, you have swag.com. There's a lot of, it's a really eclectic group.
You bring up a good point, though. So Techstars is a great idea. It's done very well. There are other incubators sort of like that that do very well. But because they do very well, there probably are a lot of imitators, right? So are there frauds out there too?
You look at, you know, tech accelerators are really at this point sort of a dime a dozen, right? I mean, there are accelerators all across the country doing all, and they sort of operate a little bit differently. The way Techstars sort of brands itself is it really it really boasts up its connections that you can make, right? So it says its network of Techstars, they can connect you to people who have been a part of the program all across the world. So their connections are really what sort of set them apart.
Okay, I want to talk about some of these companies individually. And we've talked a lot about sexism in the tech business in recent weeks. It's getting a lot of attention. Obviously, it's been getting attention for a couple of years. But tell me about this startup or this company, Allie. And convince me, because I'm not sure I'm on board with this one.
Yeah, Allie is taking a really interesting approach at sort of diversity and, you know, sexism in the workplace. They are a chatbot that sort of lives within a Slack channel. So if those words sound sort of strange and buzzy, I'll try to explain. So Slack is a workplace communication platform. We use it in our office at Inno, and basically it's a way for everybody in the office to stay connected. You can do sort of individual chats or group chats within your workplace. And this is a bot.
I stand up and go and talk to people, but go ahead.
That's right. Yeah, we are. We
well, that's
that
extraordinarily inefficient. You dinosaur.
So Allie is basically a robot that lives within your Slack channel. Lets you send a complaint about a coworker. If, say, for example, the founder gave me the example of a woman is in a meeting and is repeatedly interrupted by a male colleague. She is frustrated by that. She doesn't know exactly how to kind of express her frustration. She can go use Allie within her Slack channel to sort of go through the steps of kind of like righting that wrong and sort of getting it in through the HR channels that it needs to go through.
And they think that that will lead to more peaceful and more respectful workplaces.
Yes, and give people an outlet to sort of express instances of sort of minor sexism and sort of like really correct some of the wrongs that are happening in the workplace.
Could I complain if I was repeatedly interrupted by a woman, but I didn't consider it sexism?
I think so. I mean, right? I think what they're doing
sometimes
here,
it's just rude behavior.
Exactly, and I think that ultimately is what the platform will be. It's just a place for a better work environment.
All right, so that's Techstars.
It's collecting data. One of the reasons it's so hard to address and tackle these problems is that you don't have enough information. So I know, Steve, I know that line that jumped out to you that is it allows employees to self-report microaggressions. Right. And you probably think, okay, now you're just creating a platform for millennials to complain about everything at the office.
Just another way for me to get in trouble.
But yes, more data, the better. And I think if you can just create data, you'll solve the problem.
All right, we're going to take a break and come back. We're going to talk about co-living, which I just love this topic. I think it's fascinating. And we'll just talk about it when we get back. Tell us again. Tell me about the newsletter you guys put out.
Yeah, The Beat.
I'm sorry. Here we go.
Yeah, it's The Beat. It's our daily newsletter covering everything, covering local innovation, startups, tech, cool new restaurants. Like, if it's interesting and it's new, read The Beat. Sign up.
There's a great feel to your website. I mean, just reading the writing, whether it's, you know, Jim or Karis or whoever, you know, there's a sort of a destination of it. It's a great place for people to follow along. And I was reading today about this co-living experience, which I guess is just new to Chicago, but growing elsewhere. Company called Common.
Mm-hmm.
They've opened one building now, and they're going to open a couple more this year.
Yeah, this is a New York City startup called Common, and it's co-living. And co-living is... they wouldn't like me to say it. It's a dorm room.
Yeah.
It's a dorm room for adults. It's just opened a space in Logan Square. Anywhere from rooms are between 1,200 and 1,600 per month. Four bedrooms on a floor. You share a bathroom. You share a kitchen. You share a living room. What's unique about Common is, you're not a tenant. You're a quote unquote member. You are welcomed into the Common network. And what it allows you to do, you don't just sign a lease to that place, you sign a lease to Common, so you can float to the other Commons in Brooklyn and San Francisco, and they're adding more locations throughout the country.
And the leases can be short, right? They can be as short as 3 months.
3 months, yeah, anywhere from 3 month leases to a year lease. It's not for everyone, but I think this is pretty cool. I think it's cool for people who are maybe consultants who are traveling a lot, people who are new to cities. You know, you're moving to a new city; it's kind of spooky, right? And this puts you immediately into a community, organizes
into an episode
events.
Of Big Brother,
I guess. But this is what's so wonderful about tech is it has this amazing way of taking stuff that's been around forever and making it seem new and innovative and disruptive. Like, think about, grocery delivery has been around for 20 years, but, what's the umbrella?
Oh, the umbrella deliver?
No. The unicorn. What's the, why am I?
Blue Apron.
oh man, this is bad. The one that has raised.
We're like listening in as Will Flanagan melts down on WGN Radio.
So, anyways, it has this amazing job in sharing apartments with people, and sharing bathrooms has been around for as long as apartments are. But this is putting a real kind of clean spin on it. Airbnb, you know, didn't invent home sharing; it just was.
Right. Well, we're calling it, we're calling them dorm space, but they're very nice. They're nice looking. Karis wrote this story. They look good. But the, when it comes down to it, you're sharing a kitchen with four people who, it's not like they're roommates you chose. You don't know who they are. You're sharing a bathroom with people you don't know who they are.
Right. I mean, it is the benefits and also the, just the sort of nightmare combined with dorm living, right? Like, you don't know what you're getting. Everybody kind of has like a scary dorm room experience that happens.
Do you have any?
Well, I don't know that I can share it on air. No, but
I know that you can't. I've already heard it.
But, you know, there are, it's a gamble, but it's also sort of really interesting, especially if you're kind of willing to relocate frequently. I mean, the idea of being able to go across the country is really appealing.
Okay, so I think I've established it might not be for me, it might not be for you, but it is for people, right? Are they doing, how are they doing?
Yeah, they're doing really well. So the one in Logan Square, they say they're getting between 500 to 700 applications per week across a network of 11 homes. And keep in mind that there's only they're only going to be renting 12 bedrooms in Chicago. So that's one of the advantages they have, is they're going to keep it small so that the pool of applicants are going to be
High quality, and they don't need 500 people, right? They need 50. 12.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I think that that's one of the, I mean, again, a lot of people, you know, have gotten a creepy roommate on Craigslist. It's not bad to maybe have someone vetting that, and it's a better place, and you kind of know what you're getting.
That's Will Flanagan, Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno. Check out more at Chicago Inno online. Thanks for coming by, guys. We'll see you again next week.
And the startup's Instacart. Sorry for that brain fart.
Instacart?
Instacart.
Oh, you know what? That was worth the wait. Thanks, Will.
Listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. So are you in the market for a guitar? If so, is it an electric guitar? Probably not. Electric guitar sales are dropping fast. That's the subject of a multimedia piece put together at thewashingtonpost.com by Jeff Edgers. He joins us on a phone line now. Jeff, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, how you doing? Nice to be here. Thanks.
My pleasure. I'm glad. You know, I really have enjoyed reading this story and looking at some of the videos as well. And it's a fascinating piece to me. Let's start with just some of the numbers. How bad is the situation for the electric guitar industry?
Well, you know, what sparked my real interest is I came upon this number about new guitars sold and new electric guitars. And, you know, 10 years ago, you had about 1.5 million new electric guitars sold a year. And last year, it was down to 1 million after like a slow decline, and that was startling to me because I'm no businessman, but I mean, I hear that 1%, 2% increases in business aren't good, and you know, you're always looking for more, and then the idea of seeing a you know, so many fewer guitars sold really was startling, and then I tried to think about. You know, basically, like, why is that? You know, why would that be happening? And that took me down a road, you know, many roads. I mean, like, it took me through the idea of, you know, culturally what's happening. And I tried to think of Guitar Heroes, and it took me through, you know, what these different companies were doing.
Tell me about this guy, George Grun, and how he fits into all of this.
Well, I met George a couple years ago when I was writing about a guitar that was being pushed as like sort of like the Holy Grail. And George is a real knowledgeable guy. He's been selling guitars since the 60s and had a store in Nashville since 1971. You know, he sells guitars to Eric Clapton and Billy Gibbons and, you know, everybody. I mean, Paul McCartney's bought guitars there. So, you know, George, he also like sort of has a Rain Man-ish ability to know facts about the guitar world. Yeah. And he's, you know, he's a little glass half full, you know, or half empty. I'm sorry. But he, you know, his concern is that there are just so many new guitars flooding the market and not enough people to play them. And he feels like that's, you know, heading to a crash.
Well, let's run just quickly. So I think of Gibson. I think of Fender. You're right about PRS guitars. I don't know as much about, but are they all sort of in the same boat?
Well, you know, there are a lot of guitar companies. Gibson and Fender are important to me because it's like Ford and GM in the auto world. You know, I mean, they're the biggest. I mean, Gibson is the biggest. And, you know, their problems are for different reasons. And they're not totally about the idea of, you know, people not buying as many new guitars, but they're in part about that. They're also about how they operate as businesses and, you know, whether a guitar business should be looking at itself like any other business, which I'd say no. But, you know, Fender tried to do an IPO a few years ago and was acquiring all sorts of companies. Gibson has purchased this audio division of Philips Electronics, which is basically like a lot of speakers and wireless devices, and that's plunged them into debt. And it's created a lot of, some real turmoil in the market. Now, as this story ran, I get all these, you know, emails from weirdly defensive guitarists. I don't know why they're defensive. I like guitar, and right. I play guitar, and I want it to do well. But, you know, saying, well, you don't know Jack Smithers in Eau Claire has his own guitar company, and he's making incredible guitars, and they're doing great. Well, you know, unfortunately, many of the companies that were mentioned to me, they don't almost register because they're so small,
right.
You know?
All right, let's get to the why, because this is fascinating. You used the phrase guitar heroes earlier, you know, which refers to a computer game, which I thought might have helped sales. But you said guitar heroes, and the idea was those of us who grew up watching Clapton or Eddie Van Halen or whatever, you know, we're aging. We're not where we're buying new guitars, and there aren't really people replacing them to inspire younger people to pick up the axe.
Well, again, this is another area that I got a lot of blowback from folks. You know, if you go to see our story on the Washington Post website, which, you know, we illustrate by we bought a guitar and actually set it on fire under controlled circumstances for the design. It's pretty cool.
I mean, like, it was.
That's what I call the modern media age. But there are, you know, hundreds of comments at the end there. And a lot of people are like, you don't understand. You know, there are plenty of guitar heroes. And they just start ticking off a list of guitars who are great and young now. But that's not the point. I mean, the point is, the reason I picked up a guitar, and I'm an older man, I'm 46, but the reason I picked up the guitar is because when I was a kid, I watched Jimmy Page with his ridiculous dragon suit and a bow slapping at an electric guitar and, you know, talking to, like, gnomes. And, that, you know, you go, oh,
sure,
God,
yeah.
I want to be Jimmy Page. Now, Alan Holdsworth, who just died, I bet he was a better technical guitarist than Jimmy Page. But I don't think you'd argue that people bought guitars because of Alan Holdsworth. They bought them because of Jimmy Page. That's the point. Try to do a mental inventory of guitar heroes today, and you can't really. I mean, one person who's mentioned in my story, the CEO of Fender, says nobody's more of a guitar hero than Taylor Swift. And, you know, again, people are like, Taylor Swift, she can't play lead like Mark Tremonti. But it's the idea that Taylor Swift is someone that people want to emulate. She's on stage holding a guitar, and that sells guitars.
Well,
much more than some dude from Berkeley, you know, shredding, basically.
A couple things. So I was standing on my street last night talking to neighbors, and one of them brought up John Mayer. And John Mayer is a you know, a great guitarist, I guess, but he doesn't have that sort of guitar inspiration that would translate to others. But Taylor Swift does, I guess. And in the piece, you talk about a music store owner who also has lessons, who sees more girls now taking guitar lessons, and it's because of Taylor Swift?
I mean, that's his speculation. I mean, this is all very unscientific. There are things that I've found that were scientific, like numbers and, you know, products that were created and a direct result of them. But then there's also an unscientific thing about why someone plays. We can't go out there and take a poll,
sure,
of, you know, how effective John Mayer is in inspiring young guitarists, or whether that's he's not. I mean, you can't do that. But people clearly saw a shift once Taylor Swift became popular, because Taylor Swift does play guitar. It's notable, whether it's an acoustic or all those electric guitars she plays. People notice that. I mean, Ed Sheeran plays guitar too, and you know, that also is influential. I mean, the fact is, while they haven't been booming, acoustic guitars have been going up in sales a little bit over time. And a few years ago, they actually surpassed electric guitars, which I think would have been kind of unheard of in the days of hair metal, you know?
My daughter is
something's going on there, you know?
My daughter's a college student. She plays acoustic guitar, and she's been pestering me for an electric guitar, not because of Taylor Swift, but because of Haim, another female-led group that's out. And they, I guess, used to open for Taylor Swift, and they do a lot with electric guitars. So it's interesting to see how that shift sort of is being made here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a strange thing. I mean, the question becomes, like, what happens with the electric guitar in the end? Because, you know, I'm not saying that there are going to be no electric guitars, but, you know, when rock and roll came in, the clarinet, the accordion, the mandolin, it changed things for those instruments. Now, my friend across the street, she plays a mandolin, you know. It's not like they're gone. It's just they're not a central part of American pop culture like they used to be.
Jeff Edgers, check out the piece at WashingtonPost.com. It's a great read, fascinating watch. It was great to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Okay, thanks so much, and I really appreciate you having me.
Yep, I'm going to look into the mandolin.
Yeah, sorry, an accordion, you know?
The accordion.
Self-confidence, okay?
We have to stop right now because when I was a kid, I took one accordion lesson. Nice to talk to you, Jeff.
Thank you.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Now, Randy Schaefer is in the studio. She is a digital editor for the Chicago Tribune, comes by here most Mondays to talk about what's new in social media. Randy, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You just survived a weekend in Nashville, I understand?
I did, yes. And I wish I could sum it up in emojis.
That's the thing. So Scott Kleinberg, who used to do this and would write about social media for the Tribune before he flitted off to New York, would come in from time to time all excited about the newest emojis, and Randy had never quite understood the enthusiasm. And we get a Twitter message from him today that it's World Emoji Day. And what is it? Apple has just approved new emojis?
Yeah, so about every year or so, Apple will approve some new Unicode emojis to put on its smartphones, and those, you know, end up getting, you know, translated into Android and different devices. And so this year's batch of emojis that will be released later this calendar year have been released.
And so the significance of it, it has to be supported by the code. Is that why Apple gets to choose what emojis are used and which are not?
Yeah, it's a little bit of a technical process. And the emojis, they look different depending on your phone operating system.
And is it still eagerly awaited as it was a few years ago?
I think so, yes, judging by Scott's reaction.
I don't know if we can judge anything by Scott's reaction. All right, so what's the new crop? What are we looking for this year?
So we have a zebra, a T-Rex, which I'm pretty excited for.
Really?
A vomiting emoji.
Yes, that looks great.
For when you have cilantro on your Chipotle, I guess. That's what GQ said it can be used for. We have an exploding head, a sandwich, and what looks like a genie.
Is that a genie? Which one? Oh, yeah. There was a genie. Is that a Buddhist man praying? Or it's in the lotus position, right?
Yeah, opposite to the raw steak.
The raw steak, and those two don't go together necessarily. There's a breastfeeding emoji coming out. It's not there, but I found it online. So what do we make of all of this?
I'm kind of looking forward to the T-Rex emoji and the vomit emoji. I think I'll use those two a lot, actually.
You know, there's a man, and we were talking about this because if you're in Chicago, the joke about Chicago is you always ask, where are you from? Like your ethnicity or your, you know, your racial history. That's sort of what we do in the city. So there's a man's face here who seems, he has like white guy hair. He has a black guy beard and his skin tone looks as if he's Indian.
He is very interesting. He's pretty cute.
Would you date him? Would you date that emoji?
I don't think I would date the emoji. I like to have more conversations with my partners I date, and he doesn't look like he'd be a good conversationalist.
Well, that's because you're young. There's also a woman with a headscarf with it, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think that one's very cool, too.
All right, so there's that, the new class of emojis, and they will be coming to a phone or a device near you, what, before the end of the year?
Sometime this year, yes.
All right, tell me about this Instagram. Oh, no, one other thing. So I was reading a story you'd sent me about how to spoiler-proof your Twitter feed when it comes to Game of Thrones, which was on last night.
Yes.
And the article, I think it was in Mashable or Gizmo, I'm not sure where it was.
Gizmodo.
And they said, they predicted before the piece that HBO Now would crash. HBO Now crashed last night.
Game of Thrones is really popular.
I guess so. But there are ways to sort of... did you watch last night?
No, I was on my way back from Nashville, and I'm not a huge Game of Thrones fan.
Oh, so you don't really mind if you find out.
No, it doesn't really bother me.
Okay, but there are ways to sort of spoiler-proof your Twitter feed.
Yeah, so you can actually mute tweets based on their content. And so what Gizmodo did is it went through and rounded up a bunch of hashtags and key phrases that are often used a lot in these Game of Thrones tweets. So everything from the wall to winter is coming to the names of the characters, don't ask me to pronounce them.
Well, that's why spoilers don't ruin it for me, because I can't associate the spelling of any character with their actual character.
Right.
I don't know who they are.
Or the phrase, the wall. I mean, you could be talking about anything in 2017 America with that phrase.
Well, the thing is, winter is here. We did learn that.
Yes.
Oops, spoiler alert.
Yes.
All right. So there's that. One other thing, we talked a couple of weeks ago about people who travel and post their pictures, like sort of professional photo takers, professional tourist, right? And they send back pictures. Wasn't that the two of us? We talked about how life wasn't really as rosy as it always looked in their pictures.
Yeah, the van life.
Right, exactly. Camping. And so now there's this a new site that they're sort of cracking down on fake camping pictures. Explain that one for me.
So this is actually an Instagram handle called You Did Not Sleep There.
Okay.
And it's a knockoff of the You Did Not Eat That, which is all these skinny pretty girls holding photos of donuts and ice cream.
Okay.
And it's like, You Did Not Eat That. So this one is called You Did Not Sleep There, and it's a montage basically of these campers with their sleeping bags, their tents in the most absurd locations, perched on the edge of an iceberg, or a hammock strung up 30 feet between two palm trees, and this account is laughing at these photos saying...
And they found that there are people who do that. They set up their tent just to take a picture to say
absolutely.
We slept there, and they really never did.
Yes, they definitely did not sleep on the edge of that cliff hanging over the Grand Canyon in a 2x4 sleeping bag.
Right. Well, that is some serious spare time, I guess, if you do that.
Yeah. It also sounds kind of risky to me.
Randy Schaefer, nice to see you. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
We'll do this just in emoji sometime soon.
Yes.